Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Now, wildfires, droughts, heat waves, floods, and how labor is stepping up to the plate to fight climate breakdown.
I live in Far Rockaway, and Sandy hit us hard. There was so much despair. Most devastating thing I saw were mothers with their children outside who lost everything.
It devastated the community and the economy of the community because a lot of people lost their jobs and they didn't have any income.
Sandy showed me that we really need to pay attention to what's going on with the climate change.
I'm very proud that unions are taking a step.
They are actively working to better the wages and climate.
97% of climate scientists agree we have a climate crisis. We've raised the Earth's temperature 2 degrees Fahrenheit, largely by burning fossil fuels. The impacts have been far worse than we thought. We must reduce emissions quickly and dramatically to prevent irreversible damage. At the same time, we face a crisis of extreme inequality. Workers are no longer sharing in productivity growth, and more are living paycheck to paycheck.
After Superstorm Sandy, the Worker Institute at Cornell University convened New York labor unions to talk about the role that labor can play in addressing both of these crises.
Labor is really leading on climate change.
There has never been a better or more critical time to invest in climate action and address long-standing racial and economic inequality, say organizers of the Climate Jobs Summit.
The Climate Summit will bring together the newly established state climate jobs coalitions, labor leaders, union climate activists, environmental and environmental justice advocates, clean energy developers, policymakers, scientists, and all who want to build a clean energy economy with good union jobs. The summit will feature speakers and panelists from around the country and the world talking about how climate change and inequality are inextricably linked, dig into the once-in-a-generation opportunity to create good family-sustaining jobs by developing the renewable energy sector, and engage in a holistic discussion about how just transition for workers in fossil fuel industries and their communities.
We're joined now by Dr. Lara Skinner, director of the Cornell Worker Institute, which studies the labor and employment impacts of climate protection, clean energy, and just transition, and Jeff Volkrat, executive director, Climate Jobs New York, a coalition of labor unions representing 2.6 million working men and women united around combating climate change while reversing income inequality. With that, Lara, Jeff, what is your involvement in that mandate and how does that begin to happen, and of course, just reemphasize the imperative. It is a real and immediate occurrence, and that is climate catastrophe, change, disaster, deprivation, environmental racism that is really affecting the longevity of this planet. Lara, Jeff?
I think a big part of the work that we're doing is trying to reframe the debates around climate change. We really sort of see two crises and potentially even three crises if you now include the COVID-19 crisis. But we also have a crisis of inequality in addition to the crisis of climate change. You know, we really see these things as intertwined, and we see our role as working with unions and worker organizations, working with the labor movement to develop responses to the climate crisis that are also addressing inequality. And we think one of the best ways that you tackle inequality is by making sure that you're creating, you know, high quality, ideally union jobs that are family and community sustaining, that are helping to make communities more equitable, more resilient. And so that's a big part of the work that we're doing, is reframing this crisis and saying, hey, we need to do three things. We need to be tackling the climate crisis, building the clean energy infrastructure that we need, but we also need to make sure that these are going to be good jobs. We can't create a whole bunch of low-wage, low-quality jobs that are actually going to exacerbate the crisis of inequality that this country is facing. And we need to see this as a major opportunity to build back from the COVID-19 crisis.
Just to build on that a little bit, thinking back to the origins of climate jobs in New York, Superstorm Sandy, I think, made it very clear to a lot of people that climate change was already affecting working people. It was disproportionately affecting vulnerable communities. And a group of forward-thinking labor leaders got together with LERA and said, labor has a lot to bring to the table in driving bold climate action. And also, we need to be part of shaping these industries from the beginning, as LERA said. All of those dynamics make it really important that labor is helping drive bold climate action.
And what Cornell is doing, the labor leading on climate initiative that I run at Cornell University with organizations like Climate Jobs New York, we now have a Climate Jobs National Resource Center that's supporting coalitions of unions around the country. We're really helping to define what we call climate jobs programs. So we're developing recommendations and then building campaigns around a set of recommendations that do three things. They tackle the climate crisis, they reduce emissions to the greatest extent that they can. They invest in activities that are going to create the most union jobs, and they invest in frontline communities that have been most impacted by climate change and environmental justice issues. So, you know, we're really excited about the kind of approach that we take, which is let's identify the activities that really sort of hit the sweet spot of most job creation and most emissions reduction, address equity goals, and be really concrete. What needs to be built? How much solar do we need to build? How much wind do we need to build? How many buildings do we need to retrofit? How quickly do we need to do it? What do we need to do to transform our transportation system? How much is it going to cost? How many jobs is it going to create? And most importantly, what are we going to do to make sure that these jobs are going to be high-quality union jobs? So that's really what the work looks like on the ground and how we're responding to these crises that we see.
And Laura, can you expand on that? What are the kind of recommendations that you're looking at in terms of both mitigating the climate crisis and creating new union and high-paid union jobs?
The recommendations look different depending on where we're working. In every place that we're working in really closely with unions, their leadership, their staff, their membership, to really understand what's happening on the ground, what's their experience with the clean energy economy. But then we're also doing a bunch of research to understand how the climate crisis is impacting a particular state, what needs to be done to reduce emissions and get to, you know, science-based goals, which are, you know, we need to be to net zero emissions by 2050, probably 2045, actually. And so we look at every sector. We look at the building sector. We look at the energy sector, transportation, the industrial sector. And then, you know, like I said, you know, which sectors are producing the most emissions? Have those, you know, have emissions been increasing, leveling off, decreasing? And what sort of activities are going to need to happen to be able to reduce emissions in that sector, but also, like I said, you know, create more vibrant and healthy communities, because this is about building a stronger economy, you know, a more equitable society. That's what these investments need to do as well. So a lot of it focuses around improvements and expansions that we need to make to public transit. You know, folks are having to move farther away from jobs to find affordable housing. So they need to have, you know, excellent, reliable, safe, you know, really efficient and affordable transportation options to get them to their jobs and to get them to other essential services. We also have to build a whole electric vehicle infrastructure system in New York State and around the country. In the same way that, you know, we built the interstate highway system in the 1950s, we now need to have the same vision and action to do that for electric vehicles. There's no way that we reduce emissions and pollution in the transportation sector without shifting, you know, from, you know, fossil fuel internal combustion engine vehicles to electric vehicles. That's got to happen. And in order for people to, you know, purchase electric vehicles, they've got to be more affordable. And we've got to have, you know, a border-to-border dense charging infrastructure so that folks know that they're going to be able to get around with an electric vehicle and have enough charge. So, you know, in the transportation sector, that's generally what it looks like. In the energy sector, you know, the recommendations really focus on how we're going to scale up renewable energy. You know, that's solar, both on our homes and commercial buildings, also utility scale solar. It's onshore wind, it's offshore wind in some places. The West Coast is starting to explore wave energy. Some Midwest and Northeast states are starting to explore geothermal energy. So all of that, you know, we have to transform our energy system so that it's renewables based. In the building sector, we're currently retrofitting about 3,000 buildings a year, and we need to get up to about 3 million buildings a year that we're retrofitting. So, and that's important because it's going to make people's utility bills cheaper too, right? These buildings need to be highly efficient, and we can install renewables. We can electrify people's homes so that we're not relying on, you know, natural gas, oil, fossil fuels to heat and cool our homes. And that's it's a huge project, and it's going to create a lot of work. So building retrofits is a big part of what we're thinking about. And then we're also thinking about the industrial sector. You know, there's a lot of parts of our economy where we have not figured out how we're going to decarbonize and reduce emissions in those sectors. How are we going to make concrete? How are we going to make steel? How are we going to fly planes, power ships? How are we going to store enough power to support a renewables-based grid? There's some emerging technologies that we haven't quite figured out yet. We think there's a lot of job opportunities there, but that's part of what we're figuring out, too. We think green hydrogen, hydrogen that's produced from renewables, think about a massive build-out of offshore wind or onshore wind that could then be used to power hydrogen, could be a great way for us to have hydrogen fuel cell trucks, you know, for the trucking industry to move goods around. It could be a good way to fly planes. So there's stuff like that in the industrial sector that we're still trying to figure out too, but we're focused on, and again, really thinking about, you know, what's going to create the most jobs and how do we make sure that these are high quality jobs.
I want to pick up with something with Jess. What's the struggle and what's the effort and what's the organizing that goes into bringing the working class, organized labor, which is essential both as a pressure point for government, there's a lot of strength and power that organized labor has, and for the imperative of bringing the unions on board to really support climate justice.
Broadly speaking, I think it's fair to say that there's been a very significant shift in the public's in general, the perception that of the fact that we have a climate crisis and also the fact that we can make a meaningful difference if we act at a scale and at a pace that matters. I think the public opinion on those two questions is changing very quickly. And there are a lot of leaders in labor as who recognize we need to act on climate. There's a huge opportunity economically here. And as long as we make sure that they're good union jobs that we're creating in all of these sectors that Lara talked about, that's a huge part of an economic recovery. It's a huge part of building a clean energy economy that works for everyone. I think it's very natural for people to be skeptical if what they're seeing is good union jobs that have been organized over decades going away and being replaced by low-wage non-union jobs. I think that's a natural cause for skepticism, and it's important that we make sure these are good jobs for a whole host of reasons, including the fact that it will be much easier for everyone to buy into a transition to a clean energy economy and a clean energy future if those jobs are good union jobs and careers and community supporting jobs.
I completely agree. And, you know, just a note for the listeners, many unions have fought long and hard to make sure that jobs in the fossil fuel industry are good, you know, safe jobs. They're well paying. They have good benefits. If you look at the unionization rate in the fossil fuel power generation sector, it's around 20%. If you look at the unionization rate in solar, it hovers more around 3-4% nationally. It's a little bit higher for wind, more around 6-7%. But, you know, those numbers, you know, indicate why there's a lot of concern from unions about this transition. Right now, you know, the unionization rate in the solar and wind sectors is quite low, and we need to figure out a way that we're actually making sure that these are going to be good union jobs, because then folks actually have good jobs to transition to. And as Jeff said, you know, of course, right now there's a healthy skepticism around whether there are going to be good jobs to transition to, given the low unionization rates that we're seeing in solar and wind.
Lara, what is the government tie-in, both state, local, and federal government tie-in to this? And what is the funding for this? I assume there would need to be some kind of funding. And what is the ownership like? Who owns this? Is it the government to some extent, co-ops? Is it private industry? Who gets to gain by this in that sector?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the states where we're seeing the most action to address climate change are states that have mandated science-based emissions reductions. They have said, yes, we believe the science. We believe what the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is telling us. You know, they just released a report, Code Red for Humanity. And I think, you know, they've made the commitments. We have about 25 states now that have made the commitments to get to net zero emissions by 2045 or 2050. Some states have even said, you know, we're going to get to 100% renewable energy. Illinois just passed the most groundbreaking climate and equitable jobs legislation in the country. They have actually charted the path to shut down all of the coal plants in the state, as well as all of the gas plants in the state. And they have provided significant investment for solar and wind, particularly for solar on schools. And they have passed the most ambitious labor standards that we've seen in the country. There's prevailing wage on everything that's bigger than 25 kilowatts. So basically anything that's bigger than household solar. So I really encourage folks to check out that new legislation that passed in Illinois. It's really sort of a gold standard for how we address climate, jobs issues, and equity issues. So that's one piece, just, you know, our states, you know, taking the necessary action to say that they're committed to tackling the climate crisis at the scale and pace that's necessary. And then I think the other thing that we've really sort of focused on is that government can lead in so many spaces, right? Government can lead. We have huge vehicle fleets, state and local and federal vehicle fleets that could be converted to electric, that could, you know, and that conversion could be used to encourage domestic manufacturing of electric vehicles. This is a huge opportunity for us. We're going to have to convert our whole vehicle fleet, and are we going to manufacture this stuff in the U.S. or not? It's a big opportunity for us. There's a lot of places for the government to lead. You know, our public transit system I mentioned before, right? We need a high-speed rail network in this country. That's key to climate, to pollution, but also for quality of life so that we can get to places in a safe and clean manner. So there's a lot of places that government can lead. And I think the more that we can do in the public sector, the better. I think ultimately right now, we're really up against the clock. We need to do as much as we can to tackle the climate crisis. So it's going to happen, need to happen at all sort of scales. You know, we need to do this through co-ops, through community solar. We need to do this in the private sector, but the more that the public sector can lead, the better. In particular, I think energy is a public good. Folks should have access to good, high-quality energy. And so the more that we can do through the public sector, I think we'd be able to do it at scale, and I think we'd be able to do it more affordably if we're doing it through the public sector.
Jeff, if the issue of these things filtering down to the working populace and really becoming internalized, the time constraints on saving this planet and the imperative to begin to act now and to push government, which is far behind where they should be in enacting this, whether it's the federal or the state government. So what do you do, and how do you really approach make the working class, if you will, take ownership of these issues? So, I mean, right now, so youth has been in the leadership. How do we make the parents and working people really follow and understand the imperative for these things and the possibility for the creation of new jobs with the new technologies, which are safe and healthy for the planet?
Well, you're absolutely right that organizing is at the heart of progress here, and engaging union members and the broader community is a big part of what we do. We've got a great organizer on Long Island, for example, who is working with union members and leaders and a lot of folks in the community to drive offshore wind forward. It's also important, we've got to make sure the substance is there in a way that people can recognize a good future here and make sure these are good union jobs and careers and that communities can have the tax base they need to support themselves. And organizing and engaging and just making sure that what we have to communicate and what we're organizing for is a future where these are good jobs that that people can get excited about. I'll give you a couple of examples of how we've prioritized that work. From the beginning, the Leaders of Climate Jobs identified offshore wind as a really important step on emissions and also a big economic opportunity, and so played an important role in getting the governor to commit to procuring 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind power, which was unprecedented, is still unmatched, and doing it with high road standards, project labor agreements, prevailing wage, and to invest in port infrastructure to support offshore wind. So making sure that we are organizing to build a future that really is good jobs, good careers, is essential to getting everyone on board. Another example is our Carbon Free and Healthy Schools campaign, which we've really leaned into this year, and a lot of unions are very actively involved in that, from the teachers union, the 32BJ SEIU, which represents workers in the schools, the AFSCME District Council, the Central Labor Council, the building trades, everyone recognizing that by investing in schools, we can accomplish a lot of things at once. So we can have a big impact on emissions. Just in New York City, it's the equivalent of planting 400,000 trees. We can make schools healthier and safer for kids in the schools community, prioritizing the schools most in need of investment. We can create thousands of good union jobs. We can save schools millions in energy costs. And we can do a lot of things by investing in schools and recognizing that this is a time to go big and make the investments in schools we really need to make. That means energy audits on all school buildings, and then followed by energy efficiency retrofits and wherever possible solar power, and making sure that those are union jobs, that those are, that's project labor agreement work. Making sure that that's the future we're building is a crucial piece of getting everyone on board. Those are a couple of examples of how we've driven that forward.
And Jeff, just quickly, where are the jobs in wind? What kind of jobs are created?
There's the supply chain manufacturing of components, and we'd like to see as much of that in New York and in the U.S. as possible. There's the assembly and staging and construction of the wind farms, and then there's operations and maintenance work for the wind farms after that, and port infrastructure to support all of that. So there's a lot of different kinds of work involved in building offshore wind infrastructure, which creates a lot of opportunities.
I'm also interested in is, while the focus is on getting the powerhouse organized labor on board, you did mention earlier on, Lara, the issue of equity. And part of what we understand is the issue of creating jobs and people who are disparately kept out of the workforce, and the enormity of the discrimination and the high, high rates of black and brown unemployment. So is there an emphasis and a concern in the work that you both do for creating jobs and bringing people in who are not already part of the workforce, of the unionized sector of the workforce?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say two things about that. One, I referenced earlier that the unionization rates in the solar and wind industries are low. That's concerning because we're worried about the quality, the pay, the benefits, the security, the training that folks are receiving to install solar systems. We have heard from workers in some states that they're paid piece rate. They're paid by the number of panels that they're putting on roofs per day, that they're not receiving safety training to do the work that they're doing. So I think one of the biggest equity issues is we're going to be creating 15 to 25 million jobs in the clean energy sector over the next 15 years, which is what most studies estimate for the U.S. We need to make sure that these are good jobs, that they pay well, that folks have benefits, that they're full-time employees with security, that they receive the proper, you know, training to do the work so that they're safe on the job, and that they have, you know, collective voice on the job and the ability to organize. So I think, you know, having those standards across the board for the clean energy sector would be hugely helpful. And it's a big equity issue, right, because we have a lot of immigrant workers of color who are currently working in the solar and wind sector and other parts of the clean energy sector, like energy efficiency. That's a big equity piece that is often missed in this discussion. And then the second piece I would say is we are very focused on having project labor agreement requirements on as much of the work as possible, because we believe that that's one of the best ways to have a pipeline from underserved, disadvantaged communities into paid on-the-job training programs like pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship programs that unions and employers are running jointly. And then the important part of that is that from the pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship training programs, folks are guaranteed jobs. They are moved into careers in the construction industry and have continuous training opportunities to keep evolving their skills and, you know, maintain their career for the long term and support their family. So those are two things that I would lift up is how do we build a more equitable clean energy industry, which means that we have to have the wage, labor, and job training quality standards across the board. And then how do we drive more funding into union training programs and particularly pre-apprenticeship programs that focus on underserved communities, like bringing women into the construction trades, bringing communities of color, low-income communities, formerly incarcerated folks into these training programs and into these careers.
Your thoughts on the infrastructure plan being proposed and the environmental component of it, of government, whether it is enough and what needs to continue by organizations and efforts like yours to push government to be more aggressive on dealing with the issue of climate and the creation of good green jobs.
Looking at the investments that need to be made, and this is the time when we need to make large investments in climate infrastructure for economic reasons and also for climate reasons. We've been talking about acting at a scale and a pace that matters. As Lara said, we're on the clock. This is the time to make those investments. We are highlighting aspects of that package that are very important for New York. For example, funding and financing for efforts to renovate schools is part of what's under discussion there. And so we are certainly lifting that up as an important part of investing in climate infrastructure and investing in communities. This is a very important part of acting in a timely way.
Dr. Laura Skinner, director of the Cornell Worker Institute, and Jeff Volkrat, executive director of Climate Jobs New York, a coalition of labor unions representing 2.6 million working men and women, united around combating climate change while reversing income inequality. Thank you for joining us.
This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.